line today here, and Brian received his PhD from Berkeley. He works with Lawrence.
Yeah.
Lawrence is the advisor. He had a postdoctoral position at BU, and now you're at the Institute for Physics and Mathematics of the Universe in Japan.
It is now the Kavli Institute of Physics and Mathematics of the Universe, Tokyo Institute for Advanced Study. So they just sort of keep extending the name. Yeah, I mean, they should have taken the opportunity to add like Kavli and then like just remove some words from the end. But no. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about some work I did with Willie Klemm, who was at IPMU at the time, but now he's at Uppsala. And it involves some ideas of trying to explain flavor properties of neutrinos using a seesaw with many right-handed neutrinos, okay? So just for some motivation, if you just look at flavor and the puzzles of flavor, there's a bunch of qualitative questions you'd like to know the answers to, okay? So first of all, there's the fact that the quarks and charged leptons have these masses that span some, you know, six orders of magnitudes. Why is that? Why is it that the secant matrix is approximately equal to the identity when you order the up and down quarks by mass? And then you have the neutrinos, and their masses are strangely some 10 orders of magnitude, roughly speaking, smaller than the other fermion masses, and, you know, perhaps seemingly less hierarchical. And then there's also the fact that in the lepton sector, the mixing angles seem just fundamentally different in nature from the quark sector mixing angles, with the leptons having two near maximal mixing angles. So of all of these puzzles, I'd say the one that people feel like they may have a reasonable handle on is the smallness of the neutrino masses. Okay, we have this beautiful explanation from the seesaw mechanism, where what you do is you explain this unique smallness of the neutrino masses by taking advantage of a qualitative unique property the neutrinos have, which is the fact that the right-handed neutrinos are gauge singlets, and therefore a Majorana mass for them is allowed and could be very large. Okay, and as everyone knows, this ends up by the seesaw producing small Majorana neutrino masses. And okay, so this allows us to obtain this really beautiful understanding of at least one of these flavor puzzles, all right? But for these other mysteries, there are many different possibilities that have been proposed. Flavor symmetries of many different types, wave function overlaps and extra dimensions, and so on. And I mean, certainly it's possible that one of these ideas might end up being right, but I think it's fair to say that none stands out as being clearly as compelling as the simple seesaw explanation for the neutrino mass size, okay? And in this talk, for reasons that will sort of become clear in a little bit, we're going to take sort of an agnostic view on what's determining the size of the Yukawa couplings, all right? We're not going to invoke flavor symmetries or anything like that. And all we're going to do is we're going to just parameterize the sizes of the Yukawa couplings by some kind of random statistical distribution, all right? And you could think of this distribution as coming from a string landscape type thing, if you want, or you could just think of it as parameterizing our ignorance about what's actually going on, all right? And the reason this will end up being fruitful will be clear shortly. So if I'm going to say that I'm just going to treat the Yukawa couplings as some kind of, you know, randomly varying numbers, well, how should they vary? Well, if you look at the quarks and charged leptons, it seems like what you want is some kind of distribution that varies over some number of orders of magnitude, roughly in a scale invariant way. So you can plot the masses of the of the charged fermions. Well, actually, these are scaled up to the gut scale just for illustration. But anyway, you can see that they're roughly distributed in a scale invariant way across maybe six orders of magnitude. Okay.
Did that reference actually do it rigorously?
What do you mean rigorously?
How well fit this is to a scale invariant? How consistent?
Yeah. So, well, I guess I'll be mentioning slightly more about that in a second, but yeah. So I'll get into the numbers a little bit more in a second, but what's amusing about this is that if you just take some proposal where, you know, you take a distribution which is roughly scale invariant spanning this this number of orders of magnitude, then you can look and see what happens for your prediction for the CKM matrix elements. And amusingly, you do end up actually with statistically nice values. Okay, in particular, you do predict the correct ordering of the CKM matrix elements. And while you certainly don't have anything at all like a real quantitative prediction, you know, the prediction for each element spans, let's say, an order of magnitude. But the orders of magnitude are in the right place for each element. Okay.
Could you explain what you mean by a scale invariant distribution, which is hierarchical?
Or does it mean? So a probability distribution, which gives you an equal probability of being over, within each order of magnitude between, let's say, 10 to the minus 6 and 1.
So it's
uniform a lot. Right. All right, so let me just note that a key disadvantage to just using this kind of approach where you randomly scan each Yukawa coupling and throwing away flavor symmetries is the generation structure ends up being an accident, okay? So there's no longer any reason in this approach that you would say, well, the lightest two guys are paired together and then the next two lightest and so on. So the fact that that ends up being true, we just have to say, from this point of view, it would be a random sort of 1 in 3 factorial accident. All right, so now, at the same time that it seems like the quark and charged lepton...
Is that the same accident or a different... So one accident is that like the lightest two are an up type and a down type, and the next two... Is that the same accident you're talking about or an additional one? Part of the one you're talking about?
So, let's see. I guess that's not, that didn't have to happen. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's different. The accident you're talking about is just that the masses are, sorry, so what's the one you're talking about? I'm not sure I understood.
So it could have been that, so the weak interaction tends to pair the lightest two guys together. So it could have paired the lightest guy with the middle guy, let's say.
So really, so you get predictions for the off-diagonal Vs being hierarchical, but not for which ones are...
So when I said that you predict the CKM matrix elements, that was after you put in the requirement that the generation structure comes out right.
Okay.
All right. So, so at the same time as it seems like the quarks and charged leptons refer to this sort of, Yukawa couplings that are hierarchical and spanning many orders of magnitude, the neutrinos in their hand seem to refer relative degeneracy. Okay, and so these authors here look at a situation where you just randomly scan the neutrino Yukawa couplings at sort of order one, and they deem this neutrino anarchy. And indeed, it turns out that if you do that, you end up with statistically reasonable predictions for the properties of neutrinos. And moreover, if you try to use the same kind of distribution for the neutrinos as you wanted to use for the charged fermions, then you don't get statistically reasonable results, okay? Obtaining two large mixing angles from a hierarchical distribution of Yukawa couplings is very unlikely, okay? And I'll quantify that statement a bit later. So again, you know, this is perhaps another way of saying that the neutrinos are standing out as being unique, or it's another sense in which they're unique. And you could just conclude from this that, well, maybe the neutrinos are just fundamentally different. Okay, the Yukawa couplings are just determined in some fundamentally different way from the other Yukawa couplings. But in this talk, I want to try and take a different point of view. And I want to try to imagine that perhaps what's determining the Yukawa couplings is not necessarily fundamentally different from the neutrinos. And I want to explain why their flavor properties end up coming out different in another way. So the first thing you might think of in that direction is the seesaw mechanism itself. So you might ask, you know, the seesaw is already beautifully explaining the smallness in the neutrino masses. Could it also be somehow, you know, taking this these hierarchical Yukawa couplings you might have and mixing them up so that the mixing angles end up being large? But naively, the answer to that is no. So unless you, you know, invoke some kind of cancellations or, you know, special structure, then if you have small mixing angles before you invoke the seesaw, then afterwards you still have small angles. And you can sort of simply see that by just looking at the 2x2 case. So so if you start off with, let's say, you know, looking at what the low energy mass matrix looks like, and you start off with some hierarchical Yukawa couplings, and if you just have some order one Majorana mass matrix, then it ends up that the mixing angle that you have at the end is still suppressed by sort of the amount of hierarchy you had originally. Okay, so the moral is that typically the seesaw does not remove hierarchy. But then we get to the main idea of this talk, is that we're going to try and take advantage of the fact that the right-handed neutrinos are gauge singlets in an additional way. Okay, so we've already taken advantage of that by the fact that they can have Majorana masses. But moreover, there's not really any reason for assuming that there's three of them. Okay, gauge singlets, there's no anomaly cancellation requirements on how many of them there are. And, you know, these right-handed neutrinos are particles that are up, you know, near the gut scale. These are energy scales that we have absolutely no idea about, really. I mean, we try to make guesses, but we have never probed this regime in any remote way experimentally. And maybe there's a lot of gauge singlet particles up at that scale. Who knows? If there were, they would have allowed couplings to the operator LH, and so maybe there's lots of right-handed neutrinos. Now, if there are lots of right-handed neutrinos, then what happens is that when you go to determine what the low-energy neutrino mass matrix looks like, you end up with so for each matrix element, you end up with a sum over many different terms, okay? And so even if you had some hierarchical Yukawa couplings there, when you're summing up over many terms, you don't care about all the small ones. Okay, the only thing that ends up mattering is those, you know, perhaps couple of large Yukawa couplings you ran into in doing this big sum. And so this can end up giving you, it can end up basically washing out the hierarchy because all those smaller ones didn't matter, and you end up with eventually finding some big one for each matrix element. All right, so just a little bit of maybe some hand-wavy.
You're basically using the power factor to probe unlikely parts of consciousness.
Eventually you end up finding a big element, yeah. And that, well, it's also important that that ends up dominating the sum, yeah. So I think it's just amusing, just for some a little bit of hand-wavy top-down motivation, to note that there are a bunch of papers and literature already where there, you know, people were doing some string constructions to try to get some low energy flavor predictions and so on. And these papers, in many cases, they didn't need them for any purpose, but they did have many right-handed neutrinos, because in string theory, you do have many fields, for example, many moduli fields, which are gauge singlets, and they end up serving the function of right-handed neutrinos. So, you know, some of these papers had 100 right-handed neutrinos in them. And I think it's amusing to note that, so if...
So by 100 right-handed neutrinos, it really means that there are 100 fermions coupled
to LA. Right. Now, moreover, you can ask, okay, so for example, for moduli fields, well, I mean, in string theory, you have all these extra dimensions you need to get rid of, so you compactify them. And so, for example, for moduli fields, they end up getting masses from fluxes in the compactified extra dimensions. And so, you know, the mass scale is around the compactification scale, roughly. And so if you ask what compactification scale do we want? Well, if you just look at, so the compactification scale ends up being M Planck times a factor, which depends on the number of dimensions you compactify. But anyway, it depends on the ratio of the compactification scale compared to the string scale. And so if you want sort of a classical, you know, GR description of your compactification, you require that the compactification scale is suppressed at least by a little bit compared to the string scale. Otherwise, you know, GR doesn't describe things at all. And if you do that, then you can, you know, easily end up with the situation that the compactification scale is perhaps suppressed compared to the Planck scale by some number, you know, some number of orders of magnitude. And maybe the gut scale is a reasonable scale for that. So I would say it's not, you know, some awesome top-down motivation for this scale, but at least that's what happened in these bunch of constructions, is they ended up with the masses for these states near the gut scale where we actually want them. I'd say, okay, the main caveat to me with this argument is the fact that the reason that people are taking the KK scale to be suppressed compared to the string scale, so they have a classical gravity description, is because that's sort of the only thing people know how to actually work with. I'm not sure that's actually a real requirement. It's just what tends to appear in the literature. So, okay, you can take that with a grain of salt. All right, so one thing is that the reason that the mechanism we're talking about today is not already simply like appearing in these papers is the fact that these guys are all using wave function overlap pictures in order to get their Yukawa couplings at the end of the day. And that doesn't work for us, okay? Because if you have a wave function overlap picture for your Yukawa couplings, then the size of Yukawa couplings for a given field are all correlated with one another, okay? And so if, you know, so you end up with a given field having Yukawa couplings, let's say, that are all relatively small or all relatively big. Okay, and so so when you do this big sum that we were talking about in the previous slide, okay, you know, obviously if all the Yukawa couplings of a given field are correlated together to be big or small, then you don't end up diluting the hierarchy. Okay, so what we might want is something like flat wave functions in the extra dimensions, let's say, and have the Yukawa couplings be determined by some other physics from the fundamental theory, which, let's say, I'll leave as an open question. Okay. All right. So it's a very simple qualitative idea. All right. Question is, how can we quantify how well it works? Let's say. So, what we want to do is we want to use this mechanism to explain why it is that the neutrinos are different. Okay. Why the neutrinos have these unique flavor properties. So in order to quantify how well that idea works, what we should do is we should have a starting point where we use some distribution for the Yukawa couplings, which describes well the properties of the charged fermions. Okay? Now, that doesn't have to be the case in order for this mechanism to work, but at least it's the starting point to see if this mechanism actually can successfully explain these differences. Okay. So following the paper that I mentioned earlier, which looked at the statistical distribution for Yukawas for the quarks and charged leptons, so we'll take a distribution that they said works nicely. And let me just emphasize that it's just sort of a random choice. I mean, there's various choices you could make. In particular, you know, so they picked a lower and upper cutoff in their Yukawa couplings of a particular size, which you don't have to do. I mean, you could easily, you could change these, and then the power in your distribution that you want would change a bit. And basically, they claim to have sort of plus, so in the power in this distribution, so they claim to have sort of a plus or minus 0.1 type accuracy based on getting the masses to work out properly. But what exactly that power should be, of course, also depends on what you take, say, the cutoffs to be a bit. Okay.
Your table, delta is the power, isn't it? Delta is the
delta. Is the power. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, this is, delta is that power there. yeah, so, and then using a distribution like this, you can also look to see how the CKM matrix elements come out. So that's something we did. And you can see that, as I was claiming earlier, you know, the ordering comes out right, and the order of magnitude of each one comes out right. And you know, the probability of getting the observed value is reasonable in every case. But you, so to see an example distribution, here's VUS. So you can see that, you know, it's peaked at low mixing angles and has a long tail. So, you know, you certainly don't make a precise quantitative prediction here, but okay, you can make qualitative statements about the relative sizes. All right, so that's what we're gonna take for our Yukawa coupling distribution when we're trying to test this idea. And then we have to ask, what should we do with the Majorana mass matrix? Well, we're just gonna take it to have say some order one eigenvalue, so eigenvalue scanning between 0 and 1. And we're going to just take them to be diagonalized in a basis which is just sort of randomly uncorrelated to the Yukawa couplings. Yeah.
That choice is made in the UV? The cutoff of the 1 is made in the UV?
Yeah, that's right. So for the top, it's like 0.4 or something in the UV. So that leaves a little bit of space for the top Yukawa. Sorry.
Why not go with
dark? Yeah, so you can do that. I mean, basically, the problem is that, sorry?
Will the results actually change?
Well, I mean, the problem is that to the extent that you actually push yourself right up to the perturbativity limit, then you have perturbativity problems. So, you know, then you'd have to really worry about running effects and you'd have to, so, I mean, yeah, essentially, you could do that, but to the extent that you go right up to the perturbativity bound, then you make your life more difficult, I guess. At least, you know, with a maximum value of 1, then at least, you know, above the seesaw scale, you don't have to worry too much about running going crazy, and because obviously doing running over 100 different steps of different neutrinos would be quite annoying. Sorry? but yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's like a particular objection to doing that. I don't know that it doesn't work or something.
And for the lower cutoff, basically, chose an arbitrary cutoff, you would see no Yukawas in our range.
Well, no, I mean, actually, that's not really true. I mean, it depends on the power, right? I mean, then what it means is that the lower you take that lower cutoff, the more the
scaling variant means the power of 1.
Well, yeah, but so we're not, right. Well, we're not actually taking a scale invariant distribution. It's approximately scale invariant, okay? I mean, basically, what you could ask is if you want a truly scale invariant distribution, then that would correspond to a particular choice of this low cutoff.
Which is what?
I think what I remember is that if you take this low cutoff to zero, then the desired power goes to 0.9. So it's, I mean, I think probably it's fair to say that I think if you took a truly scale invariant distribution and you took the cutoff to zero, I believe you'd get probably a statistically okay.
Really? Because wouldn't that mean that you should, every decade you have the same probability since it's, since you're on bottom and below?
Oh, right. No, no. Oh, you're right. You're right. Sorry, sorry. In order to, right, if you want to take the cutoff literally to zero, you have to have that power be less than one.
Right.
That's right. That's right. So, okay. So, what I do remember is that 0.9 and zero cutoff works. So, right. Okay. So if you wanted scale invariant, you would have to keep that a non-zero cutoff of something. All right, so yeah, I mean, I've already sort of said this, but basically, you know, just treat the current choices we made as just sort of an example. Many of the assumptions are flexible, and you know, I don't know how much I'll be able to talk about it today, but we have tried to quantify to some degree how much we can change things around. All right, so one thing I want to point out is that I just said that the Majorana mass matrix we're assuming is diagonalized in a basis which is just sort of uncorrelated to what the Yukawa couplings are. You could ask, well, why don't we just take a simpler thing, say, and make the Majorana mass matrix diagonal? And so that actually would be bad, all right? That wouldn't work for us. And the reason is because you can write out the expression for the low energy mass matrix, and you can compare, say, a diagonal element of that mass matrix to an off-diagonal element. All right? And you can see that diagonal elements end up then being a sum of n terms, each of which involves a square of a Yukawa coupling. Whereas the off-diagonal terms are sums of n terms which involve a product of two different Yukawa couplings. And it's much more probable for a square of Yukawa coupling to be large than it is for a product of two different ones. Because if you have, you know, let's say, just following the example of the charged lepton and quark Yukawa couplings, let's say we have like 1 in 30 of them is big, okay, for the top. So if 1 in 30 Yukawa couplings is big, then there's a 1 in 30 chance that one of these terms is big. But there's only a 1 in 900 chance that one of these terms is big. So this ends up giving you diagonal terms that are statistically larger than the off-diagonal terms and small mixing angles. So that's not good. But you can ask, you know, does this problem go away if we take this sort of mixed up Majorana mass matrix like we're working with? Because you still have the squared terms contributing on the diagonal and none contributing in the off-diagonal. But the point is that now you have n squared terms that are products in both places. And so what you want is those terms to dominate. And that'll happen if n is large enough, because there's n squared of them. And so this ends up giving you a lower bound on n in order to tell you, you know, will this idea work or not. And so as a rule of thumb, taking this, you know, rough hand-wavy thing that we want roughly 1 in 30 Yukawa couplings to be order 1, then you want roughly more than 30 right-hand neutrinos in order for this to work. And note, this is also the condition that a given neutrino will typically expect to have one partner with a big Yukawa coupling. All right, so just a couple of other things. So, you know, could we take a hierarchical masses for the right-hand neutrinos, for the Majorana masses? Well, I mean, there's nothing really stopping us from doing that, but since the lightest ones will dominate the seesaw, it effectively reduces the number of right-hand neutrinos you're really working with. So, you know, then you could run into trouble that way. Okay, so then do we really need these hard cutoffs for the Yukawas? So the low cutoff, as we were talking about earlier, doesn't really matter. You could get rid of that and just alter delta a bit. On the other hand, a tail for the large Yukawa couplings could be a problem, because we want to be able to say that, you know, eventually you end up with a large Yukawa coupling in the sum, which is of some kind of typical size. And if, you know, that there's a long tail in the distribution, you could end up with that large Yukawa coupling having many different sizes. And that could conceivably be a problem. But I would say, you know, I don't view that as an issue at all, because perturbativity requires some kind of cutoff on the high side anyways. So I guess that's fine. Again, you could also ask, you know, do we have to really scan all these Yukawa couplings in like this totally independent way? So we're scanning each one by distribution independently. So that is a sort of tricky question. It really depends on exactly what kind of correlation you have in mind. So we've played with different kinds of things. Some of them work, some of them don't. Essentially, you need to avoid situations like what I was mentioning earlier, where you correlate all the Yukawa couplings of a given field to be, you know, either big or small. That's the main thing you need to avoid. Okay, and it doesn't matter, you know, real or complex. Probability distribution shape, you know, has some flexibility. Okay, as long as you have sufficiently many right-handed neutrinos, it just becomes good. It doesn't matter if you have too many or whatever. You could fit this into supersymmetry. There's no real objection to it. You just now have two Higgs doublets, and so the depending on tan beta, the preferred Yukawa coupling distributions for the quarks and charged leptons might change, but whatever. And a similar thing applies to grand unification. All right, so here's the main result. So you can look at the probability of obtaining two large mixing angles as a function of n, all right, where large means, you know, as big as the real world constraints, say, you know, the experimental preferred value minus 1 sigma, at least as big as that. And you can see that you start off, you know, 2 or so percent chance of getting two large mixing angles. And, you know, as you go up to 100, it gets, you know, 17%, let's say. And you can also look at the mass hierarchy. So, in the real world, this ratio of delta m squareds, okay, will lie at like 1.5, so around here. And you can see that for n equals 3, you know, very often end up with larger hierarchies. So that at least works a bit better when you go to large numbers of neutrinos. But the thing that's actually really interesting in this plot, so we've done a slightly non-conventional naming scheme in this plot. So what we've done is we're naming the masses 3, 2, 1 always based on the size. Okay, so 3 in this plot is always the heaviest, which is the standard convention for a normal hierarchy, but it's not the same as the usual convention for an inverted hierarchy. But the reason we did that is so that on this plot, if you're less than 0, then this is an inverted hierarchy, whereas on the right, this is normal hierarchy. So what you can see is that when we're at values that are in the real world of 1.5 or minus 1.5, then you can see that we vastly prefer a normal hierarchy compared to inverted hierarchy, okay, by about a factor of 100. So that's interesting. It's one way of at least falsifying this idea. And you can look at, this is, I think, is an amusing plot where you look at the distribution of the three angles as a function of n, okay? So here, we start off with n equals 3, and we have, obviously everything is peaked over on the left here, and then as you increase n, you can see that everything's sort of washing over to the right, and large mixing angles end up being quite probable.
The different colors are different angles?
Yeah. Well, they're colored by size, so it's just the biggest, next biggest, and smallest angle. All right, so how about some predictions? Well, I already mentioned, you know, we do predict a normal hierarchy. So that's good. It's one way of falsifying things. But, I mean, in truth, you know, unfortunately, as with the seesaw mechanism itself, it's difficult to really concretely confirm because we've postulated a bunch of new physics at the gut scale, and we can't probe that directly. After you integrate it out, you end up essentially with the neutrino masses. So mostly we can just try to make other predictions about the properties of the neutrino masses. And so there are a bunch of different parameters we can look at for predictions. Okay, MEE, the sum of the neutrino masses, theta 1-3, and so on. So let's take a look. So first of all, we'll look at MEE. So that's the 1-1 elements of the neutrino mass matrix after you diagonalize the charged leptons. What's relevant for neutrinoless double beta decay searches. And you know, hopefully, if we see this, we'll determine that the neutrinos are Majorana. Unfortunately, so our predicted value is like so. So here's the distribution, 4 plus minus 2 millielectron volts. And unfortunately, you know, this is a bit small. The currently planned neutrinoless double beta decay searches are mostly sensitive to the inverted hierarchy case. But maybe, it seems like maybe in 10 years or so, we may be able to start probing the top of this range. All right, so but at least, you know, if MEE was observed to be, you know, substantially higher than this, then it would falsify the scenario. And another thing you can do is you can look at the sum of the neutrino masses, which affects structure. So we predict a value of like so, 0.06 to 0.07. Now that's roughly what you get for having just a small M1. Okay, so M1 equals 0 corresponds to about 0.06, and then we get up to about 0.07. All right. So this is also, you know, relatively small, but it sounds like maybe we can expect to probe this with future 21 centimeter line observations. And it, again, you know, it's a way of falsifying the idea. Okay, as far as theta 1-3 goes, so when we originally wrote this paper and I made this plot, actually my collaborator made this plot, we hadn't yet had all these great new observations of theta 1-3. So this plot shows the previous situation where this shaded region is the 2 sigma allowed region. And you could ask, you know, do we have some tension with theta 1-3 because of the fact that theta 1-3 is not extremely large? Okay, do we predict it to be bigger? And the fact is that if it was observed to be down here, let's say, then indeed that would look bad for our scenario. Okay. And it's only up near the high end when things start to look statistically okay, where we have about a 10% chance, let's say. And fortunately, we have these new observations from Reno and Daya Bay, which do actually put us right up here where we want it to be. And actually, Hitoshi Moriyama and his collaborator recently looked at, you know, anarchy and how well it does with the newly observed theta 1-3, and you know, it does statistically very well, and our situation is very similar. All right, so I'm burning through this talk much faster than usual. Okay, so some comments about radiative corrections.
Can I just ask something about the distributions, the way you generate distributions? So did you have one sampling out of which you extracted all the locales, including the locales for quarks? Or did you do it's just the neutrinos on
So what we did is we fixed the Yukawa coupling distribution in order to get the quarks and charged leptons to look statistically nice, okay, including, and then we fixed the distribution and then looked to see what the predictions look like for the neutrinos.
But isn't that a little bit, shouldn't that be extracting all of them at the same time?
So in principle, you could ask, what's the best fit to everything at the same time?
No, but it's more of an issue of, you know, if you already extracted from, you know, seeing two Yukawa very close to each other, it's much less likely than in this sort of scale invariance, and they're not close to each other. So
seeing two Yukawas close to each other. Sorry, I guess.
You're not, in a sense, you're not taking into account the repulsion of your powers away from each other.
I don't understand. What do you mean by repulsion?
That your probability distribution says that the powers really shouldn't be very close to each other in scale.
Okay. Yeah.
But by not including where the your powers for the quarks are, you're essentially letting your neutrinos But that just fixes you what distribution is. But it's not telling you how likely it is for you to draw all those Yukawa from those distributions.
Well, so I mean the Yukawa coupling.
It's a simultaneous draw, right?
I mean, certainly the choices that were made by nature for the quark Yukawa couplings by assumption of independence doesn't influence the probability of getting certain neutrino Yukawa couplings. So, I mean, the point was just to choose a distribution which gives you statistically good chance of drawing the quark Yukawa couplings that we in fact drew, and then see if that same distribution can give you acceptable predictions for the neutrino flavor properties. Okay. All right, so just a couple of comments about radiative corrections. So you might worry that since above the seesaw scale we have all these right-handed neutrinos, you could worry that there could be substantial loop effects. And of course, this would depend on the nature of physics at the seesaw scale, you know, where the subsequent cutoff is, and so on. But I'd say, in general, at least with this upper bound on the Yukawa couplings of 1 that we've been working with, you know, at least in that case, you don't end up with significant loop effects, and that, you know, the mixing angles and so on don't change very much if you take into account the running. But, you know, as we were talking about earlier, certainly that depends on what that upper bound was. And if you took it to be up at the perturbativity limits, then by definition, you end up with substantial loop effects. So aside from changing the mixing angles and so on, the other kinds of loop effects you might ask about are, for example, you know, if you have low energy supersymmetry, you can get contributions to slepton masses, which are non-universal and which can lead to dangerous FCNCs. You know, again, this is not dangerous given the choices that we've made, but could be dangerous if you take larger Yukawa couplings. And of course, it also depends on the phenomenology of low-energy supersymmetry, if it actually exists. And another thing that's kind of interesting is that if you don't have high-scale SUSY, so if we just have, let's say, the standard model up to high scales, then having all of these right-hand neutrinos can give you a radiative correction to the Higgs-Korda coupling. Okay, and given that, well, the Higgs-Korda coupling ends up determining the Higgs mass, then given the current LHC constraints on what the Higgs mass is, and let's say you want it to be 125 JeV, then you get it, you know, then the Higgs Porta coupling has to be a certain size, and you can worry about radiative corrections being too big and requiring, say, a fine tuning in order to get the right Higgs Porta coupling. And so you can go and calculate what the contribution of the Higgs Porta is, and it, you know, it depends to the fourth power on the size of this sort of upper bound on the Yukawa coupling. So it's quite sensitive to that. But if you put that up at one or higher, then you can run into a bit of trouble. So it's possible to end up requiring a cancellation here. So I would say, you know, if you have supersymmetry at high scales, though, this effect isn't there. So, you know, it certainly depends on many assumptions about high scale physics and cancellations and what the upper bound is. But okay, it's just an amusing constraint to keep in mind. All right, so the conclusions are that neutrinos, of course, they have these unusual flavor properties, and we can explain all the properties of neutrinos within the Seesaw framework, and explain why the neutrinos are different from the quarks and charged leptons just by assuming there's lots of these gauge singlet right-handed neutrinos, and you know, the framework is flexible. It's sort of a generic, it's a generic sort of mechanism. It doesn't require very specific assumptions. You end up with non-hierarchical masses coming from sums over many hierarchical terms. And we predict a normal hierarchy, and MeE is around 5 millielectron volts. Sum of the neutrino masses is about 0.06 eV. And large values of theta 1-3 are preferred, which agrees nicely with the recent results from Reno and Diabe. Okay, thanks. Actually, since I have an extra minute, I'll just note that. Well, let's see. So, I mean, I can just show you that we tried playing around a little bit with different kinds of distributions and some different assumptions. So we can look at the probability of getting two large mixing angles as a function of n in a bunch of different cases. So here's the base case that I showed you before. You can raise delta and see what happens. And here you don't do as well, because what's happening here is that with even with 200 right-handed neutrinos, you know, this distribution is making it less probable to hit the upper bound. So basically, the point is that you have some upper bound on the size of the neutrinos, and you need your distribution to be such that you have a reasonable probability, given the number of neutrinos, you need to have a reasonable probability of actually reaching that bound. So if you take delta to be too big, then, you know, eventually this would become good again, but you need to take that many more neutrinos, okay? And all right, so here's that case where we took no lower cutoff and we took delta of 0.9, and it, you know, gives similar results. And here we took hierarchical Majorana mass matrix elements, and you know, you get similar results. So you can see, you know, to some degree, like, these very specific assumptions don't matter so much. These are the probability of obtaining two large mixing angles, where large means sort of above the experimental constraint.
It's probability that I take 20.5, say, and divide it by 200, good probability.
That's
the...
No, this is just the number of F neutrinos.
This is any not three right-handed neutrinos. This is 200 right-handed neutrinos.
I just have a couple of parts of the numbers here than one.
So,
like,
yeah.
There you go.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Divide by 100 if you want.
I think I'm disagreeing with the way you're interpreting your probability. So, back to what I asked you before, but let me say it in a different way. So let's talk about larger powers, because top, for example, we need to expand the top, so larger powers. So you start by saying, I'll see what kind of probability densities will give me a reasonable chance of getting a larger power. So you pick the probability density, and then you're extracting the neutrinos, right? And then you're saying at that point, okay, I'll see what kind of values agree with experiment and how likely they are for the, given that probability density with what I have for neutrinos. But you're not counting the fact that you already took a hit from the from matching the initial things with the quarks. And what you should really be asking is, because you also need some maybe some larger power for the neutrinos, what you should really be asking is globally, with a given probability density, what are the chances of me having two larger powers? Because I have the top and I have the ones in the neutrino. And that is much smaller. And you're not accounting that because you're only asking how likely is it for my probability density to come for the neutrino part.
I mean, somehow the question that we're asking is not so much how good a fit. Like, so it sounds like you're asking.
The number of fit. Take your probability density you have, and now ask if I extract all the Ocalas, if I demand that all my Ocalas come from it, how likely is it for me to see more than one large Ocala? That's the real question you need to ask that has the meaning of the question. Let me give you a very exact example. Suppose you have to, I'm just making it up. Suppose you have to come up with two larger powers for the neutrino set. Then in total you have three, right, with the top.
And for what it's worth, well, I'm not sure why you say that we want larger powers for the neutrino set, but it's sort of just...
Just to make the, well, we shouldn't hold the whole discussion on that, but just to give you an exact example of where that thing breaks down. What you should really be extracting is from the full probability distribution, not to match to the quarks. Because even in that matching, you're taking some heat from your probability density.
I mean, let's see. It sounds to me like you're trying to ask, you know, if I assume that I have a distribution which looks like a power law with upper and lower cutoff, how good a fit does it give to all of the quarks and charged leptons simultaneously?
Real full question you should be asking. Because your assumption is making this, you're assuming that nature is giving you all of those guys from that distribution. And so you should ask, how is all my data agreeing with that distribution?
So.
Because you're basically what you're forgetting to take the heat from the original match you made for that distribution. So when you're saying that I have a 15% or whatever probability of getting those values for the neutrinos, that 50% should really be multiplied by an additional 10% that you took on the quark match. But it's only 10% likely to get that thing for the quarks. And that brings you down to a percent level.
I mean, of course, I don't know if this is quite addressing your point, but I mean, of course, the more and more, if you ask what's the probability that we get exactly this particular set of numbers, then obviously it goes to zero the more precise you ask. But I mean, I would say like what you want is to have a reasonable chance of getting each qualitative feature.
Yeah, let's just have it afterwards because people's like,
yeah, I had a dumb question. Right? So I want to make sure I really understood that what the probability distribution was that you were doing. Because I don't think you might have said it, I might have missed it. What did you assume what the masses of these zero guys were? So is the idea that they're all the same mass and then you've got some distribution?
The distribution of the masses of which?
Well, you have
the Majorana guys?
Your probability was 1 over lambda to the power of lambda was eukalpin, right? So that was the thing with the random variable was eukalpin. Whereas the mass of the neutrino was that squared, as I understood it, divided by the mass of the zero. So when you calculated them in these masses, was the idea that all of those zero neutrinos had the same mass?
But we're scanning, so we're scanning not over the masses, though. We're scanning over the matrix. So each element of the matrix has some element. So each element of the matrix is scanning randomly according to the distribution that I said.
For both of them.
And then you have to diagonalize them. So the Yukawa coupling matrix scans according to the distribution that I said.
Yeah.
The Majorana mass matrix we just took to have sort of order one value. So. Yeah. Although, you know, this case here is the case where I took the same distribution for both those matrices, just for argument's sake.
Not that sound.